Chapter 42 From Cross to Crown. For the wisdom of this world is foolishness with God. For it is written, He taketh the wise in their own craftiness. Paul, 1907. Chandler and the New York World probed all the county records regarding Mrs. Eddy's property, and made much of a fact they uncovered. Mrs. Eddy had not paid her taxes in full. The prosperity of Concord was largely due to Mrs. Eddy's residence there. She was undoubtedly the city's most generous donor to every worthy cause. But when, because of her wealth and fame, the city fathers elected to mulct her by overtaxing Pleasant View, she made a silent protest. She had the money with which to pay this excessive tax, but it was God and not the city fathers that dictated all her acts. So the leader of Christian Science paid what she felt was just and right, and the city did not press her for the unpaid balance. Gilbert Carpenter said of this, "This country belongs to its citizens, and the government of country, state, and city functions solely for the benefit of the common citizen." When she found the city fathers embracing the opportunity to mulct her when it came to taxes, she protested in the only way at her command, and that was to refuse to pay them in full. And her attitude is an example for her followers. Whereas they should be willing to do all that is right to support their country in every way, they should never sit back and submit to injustice without a protest. The injustice to and persecution of Mrs. Eddy continued daily in the newspapers, with no apparent progress on the case. On June 5th, Streeter and Hollis filed a motion for Mrs. Eddy, requesting an immediate investigation and speedy decision. On the same day, June 5th, Judge Chamberlain denied the trustee's motion to replace the next friends. 2 days later, June 7th, Chandler filed an amendment requesting a jury trial, and according to Michael Meehan, quote, contended long and earnestly, end quote, for same. Mrs. Eddy had many conferences with her lawyers at Pleasant View, and it was probably about this time that God told her the steps to take, which differed from their learned opinions. The attorneys were all in agreement as to the proper course of action, but they could not convince Mrs. Eddy with all their arguments. In her Life of Samuel J. Elder, biography of her father, Elder's daughter, wrote of this interview at Pleasant View, "They made no impression. Mrs. Eddy was obdurate. The opposite position was the only one which could be sustained. She spoke quietly and reasonably, but imperiously. Her brilliant black eyes shone with determination. The lawyers were very patient with her. She was an old woman, nearly as old, my father recalled, as his mother. Her person commanded deference, but clearly her legal opinion was valueless." The conference had reached this impasse when the hour came for Mrs. Eddy's drive. She dismissed her lawyers, who adjourned to Mr. Streeter's office to continue their discussion. A very short time later, a Negro boy who was a servant in Mrs. Eddy's household appeared at Mr. Streeter's office door, saying that Mrs. Eddy was outside in her carriage and wished to speak to Mr. Elder. He went out immediately, and when he came to her carriage, she reached out her hand and quietly laid it upon his arm. "Mr. Elder," she said with great impressiveness, looking steadily at him, "you are wrong in this matter, which we have been discussing. I wish that you would return to the other gentlemen and ask them to reconsider it. Will you do that?" He assented reluctantly. Then she repeated, "Mr. Elder, you are wrong." Her carriage drove off, and Mr. Elder slowly remounted the steps to the office. The situation was awkward, but having given his assent, Mr. Elder could do no less. He returned to the conference, told of Mrs. Eddy's request, and insisted that they reconsider their decision, all the time regarding the matter in the same light as did his colleagues. So they went over all their arguments again. The result was that they reversed their decision, followed the lines insisted upon by Mrs. Eddy, and during the trial it became indubitably clear that she had been right. Quote, "The children of this world are in their generation wiser than the children of light," end quote. But their day is past. It was the wisdom of this world that was seeking to overcome the woman, and she saw the subtlety of their plan and foiled it. It is doubtful that her attorneys agreed with the course she insisted upon, but they acquiesced. On Monday morning, June 10th at 11 a.m., their motion of June 5th was to be heard. But to the surprise of all present, Mr. Streeter, quote, announced that he would not at that time press upon the court for consideration the motion then pending, and asked to have a hearing on the consideration of it suspended for the time being, end quote. The world and the world were caught off guard. This was not what they had expected nor planned. Chandler immediately filed a motion, demanding that a hearing for the motion be ordered. He also filed requesting the court to allot from Mrs. Eddy's estate funds to pay for the next friend's action. This latter motion and that for trial by jury were both denied about the same time that Fred W. Baker withdrew from the case. Mrs. Eddy, in the meantime, was pursuing a new course. She granted an interview at Pleasant View to one of America's foremost journalists. Arthur Brisbane had been Sunday editor for Pulitzer's New York World before he became managing editor of Hearst's New York Evening Journal. His was one of the first newspaper columns to become syndicated, and by the 1920s, he was the highest paid journalist in the United States, if not in the world. But he will be remembered by future generations for his interview on the 8th of June in 1907. On that Saturday afternoon, at about 2 o'clock, he approached what he described as, quote, "extremely simple and unpretentious, a plain little frame dwelling, situated rather close to a country roadway on the side of a most beautiful New Hampshire valley," end quote. That was the journalist's impression of Pleasant View. He said the house was furnished very plainly and scrupulously neat, and also that those who called it, quote, "a house of mystery," end quote, were, quote, "writers of strong imagination," end quote. As a matter of fact, the house is about as mysterious as the average little New England home. All the doors, downstairs and upstairs, are open. General Streeter, who was also present on this afternoon, had talked with Mr. Brisbane prior to the interview. The writer was deeply impressed by Mrs. Eddy's beauty and youthful appearance, and her spirituality caused him to write, quote, "Nobody could see this beautiful and venerable woman and ever again speak of her except in terms of affectionate reverence and sympathy," end quote. He regretted that he could not report what Mrs. Eddy wore because, quote, "With Mrs. Eddy, you see only the face, the very earnest eyes, and the beautiful, quiet expression." When she was asked to discuss the lawsuit affecting her and other matters now in the public mind, she became very earnest, absolutely concentrated in expression, voice, and choice of words. She spoke sometimes leaning back in her chair with her eyes turned upward, sometimes leaning forward, replying to questions with great intensity. She said to one of her friends, quote, "Please close the door," end quote, and then talked freely on all the business matters that affect her. Asked why the lawsuit had been started, seeking to take away from her control of her money and of her actions, Mrs. Eddy replied in a deep, earnest voice that could easily have been heard all over the biggest of her churches. Quote, "Greed of gold, young man. They are not interested in me. I am sorry to say, but in my money and in the desire to control that. They say they want to help me. They never tried to help me when I was working hard years ago, and when help would have been so welcome," end quote. Streeter had impressed upon Brisbane before the interview his desire that the writer ascertain positively for himself Mrs. Eddy's business competence. So for at least half an hour, he asked detailed questions, quote, "with an insistence that in the case of a woman of Mrs. Eddy's age would be most unusual and unnecessary," end quote. Mrs. Eddy's mind on all points brought out was perfectly clear, and her answers were instantaneous. She explained clearly her reasons for entrusting her property to trustees and described the character of each. In praising her cousin, a former congressman and at present a member of the legislature, Mrs. Eddy laughingly described him as a very good man, quote, "and as honest as any lawyer can be," end quote. She laughed more like a young girl than a woman of 86 as she said this, looking quizzically at her thoroughly trusted lawyer, General Streeter. Brisbane tested the leader's ability in reading and writing during the interview, which became three separate talks during the course of the afternoon. She read aloud and wrote a note at his request. She also wrote her name upon a photograph of herself, which had not before been seen, and gave Mr. Brisbane permission to publish it. His lengthy interview appeared in the Cosmopolitan magazine for August, wherein the author stated that he was, quote, "not a believer in Christian Science, but a believer in material science, in non-sectarian government, and in the absolute right of Christian Scientists to believe whatever they choose," end quote. Brisbane's impressions could be summed up in these words. The lawyers who oppose her would like to show that Mrs. Eddy is not fit, mentally or physically, to take care of herself or of her fortune, which is considerable. They would like to remove her from her present surroundings and make her physically subject to the will of others appointed to control her. Success in this effort, in the opinion of the writer, would be shameful, a degradation to all womanhood and old age. Mrs. Eddy said in her interview, quote, "Young man, I made my money with my pen, just as you do, and I have a right to it," end quote. Mrs. Eddy not only has a right to it, but she has the mind to control it. On the day Arthur Brisbane was at Pleasant View, the executive members meeting in the original Mother Church sent a message of appreciation to the leader. The next day, June 9th, was Communion Sunday at the Mother Church. The auditorium was well filled, but there was not the general attendance from all over the world because of the recent bylaw inviting members to attend only triennially. Mrs. Stetson attended both meetings, and there must have been something against her in the Boston papers that Sunday, for she wrote Mrs. Eddy from the Hotel Touraine, where she was staying. June 9th, 1907. My precious leader, I am glad I know that I am in the hands of God, not of men. These reports are only the revival of a lie, which I have not heard for a long time. It is a renewed attack upon me and my loyal students to turn me from following in the footsteps of Christ by making another attempt to dishearten me and make me weary of the struggle to demonstrate my trust in God to deliver me from the, quote, accuser of our brethren, end quote. It is a diabolical attempt to separate me from you as my leader and teacher, and thus deprive you of your faithful student and her faithful students, who are living as far as they can demonstrate according to your teachings in science and health. We are striving to emulate your holy life and to trust in God as you do in every hour of sorrow or joy. My disloyal students and others are determined to destroy me and my work. Their efforts to prevent me from loving and obeying you as leader and teacher are futile to terrify me. I shall follow your example of trust in God so far as I can, and God will never forsake me, nor any who puts his trust in him. Oh, dearest, it is such a lie. No one who knows us can believe this. It is vicarious atonement. Has the enemy no more argument to use than it has to go back to this? It is exhausting its resources, and I hope the end is near. You know my love for you, beloved, and my students love you as their leader and teacher. They follow your teachings and lean on the, quote, sustaining infinite, end quote. They put their trust in God and recognize you as the messenger who brings to them the message of salvation from sin, sickness, and death through making their atonement with the Creator, the one God, who is the source and supply of every need. They who refuse to accept you as God's messenger or ignore the message which you bring will not get up by some other way, but will come short of salvation. I see the subtle suggestion of the enemy and am not afraid. My trust is in God. I know, and my students know, that we must work out our own problems as you work out yours, but we shall follow your teachings and strive to emulate your example and love you as our leader. Your Father is our Father. He will protect us, and he has and ever will protect you. We have much to do to stand in this hour, but we trust in God. Dearly beloved, We are not ascending out of sense as fast as we desire, but we are trusting in God and are putting off false mentality and putting on the mind of Christ. This lie cannot disturb you, nor me. I love you. My students love you. And we never send out such thoughts as are mentioned. Your loving child, Augusta. Augusta was experiencing the very thing the leader had described in a lesson to her household workers a few days earlier. Quote, "What I am reaching is the spiritual. The material fights it. It will do it to you. The more spiritual the thought, the more will you be fought." End quote. Mrs. Eddy did not need this letter to know that Mrs. Stetson was sincere and dedicated and that the stories were lies. But the field did. So she had it published in full in the Sentinel of June 22nd. The leader was well aware of Augustus's steadfastness, as well as of the envy and jealousy this devoted disciple aroused in others. Mr. Carpenter said, "Mrs. Stetson had the finest church in the field. She had the wealthiest and most socially prominent students in New York among her congregation and association. These students would give her anything she wanted, and they did give her much. Her students, who were businessmen, advised her in her investments so that she might be prosperous and live in elegance. All this served to inflame the envy of others who were not as wealthy or prominent as she was. I can recall that Mrs. Stetson's errors formed the chief topic of conversation among many careless students. The gossip about her was equal to that in an old people's home. Yet she was a brilliant woman with a recognized ability and understanding of leadership far greater than any other student I ever knew outside of our leader. The latter knew about the envy and jealousy aimed at Mrs. Stetson and perceived that the whole thing was animal magnetism. Perhaps Sarah J. Clark was at Pleasant View by June 2nd when Mrs. Eddy said to her mental workers, "When Christian scientists come to Pleasant View, I demand of them that they leave their belongings and take up the cross. You cannot win the crown without bearing the cross." The leader had so much to give to her disciples, and she knew how soon this great privilege of sitting at her feet was to be removed from them. She yearned to give them more in the passage from Sense to Soul, quote, "in which," end quote. She told them, quote, "we must each take part," end quote. But so few were willing to leave, quote, "their belongings and take up the cross," end quote. Clara Shannon came from England for a visit in 1907, very possibly to attend communion in the Mother Church, plus the annual meeting on Tuesday, June 11th. When Miss Shannon visited Pleasant View, Mrs. Eddy hoped that she would remain with her. But she told Clara if she felt she must return to England, she should begin teaching there. If Clara had known that the golden opportunity she was passing by would soon be unavailable, she probably would have remained with the leader. But she did not. She returned to England and held her first class there in 1907. In later years, Miss Shannon titled her memoirs, quote, "Golden Memories by One Who Is Grateful to Be Able to Testify to the Truth About Our Beloved and Revered Leader," end quote. On June 15th, Mrs. Eddy granted a second press interview. This time, the fortunate journalist was Edwin J. Park of the Boston Globe. When he was ushered into Mrs. Eddy's study at 2 p.m. that Saturday, the leader arose, stepping forward, and welcomed him with a firm handshake and the words, "Mr. Park, I am very glad to see you. I am glad to welcome you here, for I am aware of the fairness with which you and the Boston Globe have treated me." In his brief description of Mrs. Eddy's attire, Mr. Park noted that she, quote, was dressed in a black silk dress with white lace about her throat and wrists, that her lace collar was caught at the throat with a diamond sunburst of great beauty and undoubted value, end quote. Mr. Park had no idea of the significance of Mrs. Eddy's diamond brooch. For some time, Mrs. Eddy had had a crown of diamonds breastpin, which had been given to her by a devoted student. This pin was, quote, of great beauty and undoubted value, end quote. Could it have been what Mr. Park described as a sunburst? In public appearances in the past, the leader had always worn her cross of diamonds. On June 8th, 1 week earlier, Arthur Brisbane had noted that she wore, quote, no jewelry of any kind, end quote. She had removed the cross, but on that date, General Streeter had not yet asked the court to suspend the hearing. Now the tide has turned. This is the ascension era, and she has risen. It is most probable that she is now wearing her diamond crown. When Mr. Park asked Mrs. Eddy to tell him something about, quote, the next friends, end quote, litigation, she replied immediately with the trace of a smile, quote, "You mean the next friends alias next enemies, do you not?" Later in the interview, Mrs. Eddy, quote, summoned the bohemian housekeeper to the study, end quote. This was probably Anna Mahacek, whom Park described as a young woman who had been recommended to Mrs. Eddy by a Western Christian Scientist and who was greatly appreciated by Mrs. Eddy. The housekeeper was plainly flustered at her unexpected summons before the head of the house, and she started in to apologize for her appearance, although there was nothing about it that required an apology. She was a neat, wholesome-looking young woman in the attire in which she had been at her duties about the house. Everyone loved Anna, beginning with the Western practitioner who had first found the lonely girl in a Czech colony in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Shy Anna had fled from her European farm home to escape the marriage her prosperous father had arranged and was lonely in this new world. Her new friend taught her to read and write English, coordinating Anna's Bohemian Bible with the English Bible and Science and Health, and she soon recommended the willing, cheerful girl as a laundress at Pleasant View. Anna's fine qualities were not unappreciated, and it was not long before she was promoted to housekeeper. When she left Pleasant View, everyone missed her. Mr. Park probably saw Anna after she had returned at Mrs. Eddy's request to serve again at Pleasant View. William B. Johnson wrote to her, "Our dear Anna, I am so glad to know that you are again with our beloved leader. She loves you, and I know you love her, and your willingness to leave all to serve her will be rewarded." Anna's willingness was rewarded. By 1909, this sweet, eager young woman was a successful Christian Science practitioner in Cedar Rapids. On June 16th, when Edwin Park's interview appeared in the Globe, Herman Herring induced the leader to give another interview of an entirely different sort. One Christian Scientist visiting the Concord Church in June was Eva Thompson from Burlington, Iowa. Eva was also a good friend of the George Glover family in Leeds, South Dakota, and felt that she might be able to afford a reconciliation between Mrs. Eddy and her son. During their interview, Mrs. Eddy wrote a short note which she asked Miss Thompson to deliver to her son. George Glover and his daughter were back in Leeds in the summer of 1907, and when Miss Thompson arrived at their home, her reception was less cordial than usual. She wrote in her reminiscences, "I, however, made nothing of it, and delivered to Mr. Glover the letter which his mother had written. He retired with other members of the family to read the message, and left me with Mrs. Glover. On his return, Mr. Glover asked me if Mr. Fry hadn't gotten hold of me. I assured him that I hadn't even seen Mr. Fry, but that through Mr. Herring had obtained an interview with his mother, that all the advances had been made by me, and that unsolicited, I had gone to Concord, seeking ways and means of reaching his mother in order to get help for him. But Mr. Glover did not believe a word I said." After a short conversation, the situation began to ease a little. After that, there seemed to be a kind, receptive thought, and I spent a very pleasant and profitable 2 weeks. I would like to mention the physical conditions I found there. Mr. Glover was in a very dazed condition all the time, constantly falling asleep during a conversation, and later going sound asleep during the church services. Mary manifested a very angry eruption on her face. After a few days of reading the lesson morning and evening, and lovingly correcting the suspicions and misconceptions in regard to his mother, these physical errors gradually disappeared. During all the time I was in the home, every day and part of the evenings, a young man from New York would visit them. He said that he represented a group of wealthy people in New York who wished to help Mr. Glover develop his mind. However, with all this talk, he took no steps toward that end. He seemed to have convinced Mr. Glover that he was his friend and was there to help him. I recognized him as being a regular detective and agent, hypnotist, of Mrs. Eddy's enemies, and told Mr. Glover so in no uncertain terms. The thought I held to all the time was, quote, "Mental malpractice cannot put man to sleep to his best interests," end quote. After that, Mr. Glover was wide awake, both mentally and physically, and would listen to what I had to say without falling asleep. On the last day of Eva Thompson's visit, the Glovers brought Mrs. Eddy's letter, which Miss Thompson had delivered to them, to the breakfast table, and read it aloud. Mrs. Eddy had written to her son on June 16th. "I love you, my only child. Why do you allow yourself to be used to bring this grief and trouble on your own aged mother? As ever affectionately, Mary B. G. Eddy." Eva burst into tears. and before long the whole family was crying. Before she left that day, George Glover told her that he would do all in his power to end the suit. A few days later, he left for the East for that purpose, but that is another episode. The day after Mrs. Eddy saw Eva Thompson and wrote the note to her son, an attorney in Baltimore, Maryland, John Henry Keene, wrote an appreciative letter to the leader. A non-Christian Scientist, Keene had come to the defense of Mrs. Eddy and her cause in 1902 with a pamphlet titled Christian Science and Its Enemies, which action Mrs. Eddy had acknowledged and appreciated. However, Keene was fighting fire with fire, which method Mrs. Eddy could not endorse, much to Keene's disappointment. His letter of June 17, 1907, indicates that he may have begun to appreciate the leader's pacific methods. Reverend and most revered leader, deeply discerning and serene in her meekness, calm in this insolent hour of shamelessness and serpentine craft, bowing her anointed head to the acts of persecution, the unexampled founder of Christian Science is making one of the holiest demonstrations of Christ. Your wonderful course is enlightening mortal thought throughout America, Europe, and in the far-off islands of the seas, towering above the highest in spiritual power and grandeur, what canonized saint since the days of Christ has been the pioneer of so vast, so fundamental a revelation, and so religious a reformation as Christian Science? Made a spectacle unto the world, your grand struggle with the crisis of error constrains the heartfelt sympathy for you of enlightened Christendom. The sons and daughters of Christian Science behold in their sacred leader the restorer of an uncompromising high spiritual discipline, not less than the loving mother strengthening the weak hands, confirming the feeble knees, full of sympathy, full of sweetness, full of gentleness, full of patience, full of allowances, full of long-suffering, and of that goodness which is the fruit of the Spirit. The watch of your night is far spent. The newborn day will right soon be upon us, fair as the newborn star that gilds the morn. Reverently, John Henry Keene. On June 27th, quote, in this insolent hour of serpentine craft, end quote, Judge Chamberlain appointed a master and ordered an investigation to determine, quote, whether said Mary Baker G. Eddy is competent to intelligently manage, control, and conduct her financial affairs and property rights, end quote. The next day, June 28th, Mrs. Eddy granted a third press interview, this time to the very well-known foreign correspondent for the Chicago Record-Herald, William E. Curtis, who was spending several days in Concord and other parts of New Hampshire. On his return to Chicago, his article in the Record-Herald was headlined, Mrs. Eddy, marvel in mental activity, vitality wonderful in a woman of 86 years, who still seems in perfect health. Mr. Curtis had recently returned from China, and Michael Meehan, who accompanied him to this interview, recalled in later years that Curtis made a statement about affairs in China touching, which Mrs. Eddy asked for more detailed and definite information. And quite unconsciously, seemingly, she took the topic entirely out of his grasp and dwelt on the details of the Chinese situation with such a wonderful insight and with such intimate knowledge of its social, political, and economic conditions as to quite confound the man. As we drove from Pleasant View, Mr. Curtis marveled how a woman who so completely excluded the world could possibly know so much about the world's affairs, and particularly how she could have acquired such accurate and comprehensive acquaintance with the history and national habits of the Chinese, a people so little known, and with the court customs and the unpublished intrigues of its rulers. As we parted, he said, quote, "Just one more surprise, one more instance of where we came to preach and remained to pray," end quote. In his article in the Record Herald on July 19th, Curtis said, "Everyone who has come to Concord, impressed with the belief that there was some reason or justification for the lawsuit instituted by the so-called, quote, next friends, end quote, and who has had opportunities to talk with this remarkable woman, has gone away with the well-defined conviction that among sane people, Mrs. Eddy is one of the most sane, that among responsible people, she is one of the most responsible, and that among competent and successful businessmen and women, she is one of the most competent and most successful." Michael Meehan editorialized in the Concord Daily Patriot that Curtis's words about Mrs. Eddy, quote, "will be read by millions of Americans and will be believed by them," end quote. Meehan also quoted Curtis's words in describing their visit. "There was no difficulty in securing an interview with Mrs. Eddy. As soon as Mr. Meehan, editor of the Concord Patriot, notified her household, I received an invitation to call at Pleasant View at 2 o'clock, and he went with me." As we entered her study, Mrs. Eddy arose from an easy chair in which she had been sitting beside a desk, covered with correspondence and books, and gave me a hearty greeting. Her hand is thin and almost transparent. She was dressed simply in a white shirtwaist, trimmed with a good deal of lace and a black skirt. A gauze scarf was thrown over her shoulders, and a brooch of diamonds with delicate settings in the shape of a coronet was fastened at her neck. Her hair is abundant and perfectly white, and is dressed low on her forehead with graceful waves. Her eyes are full, clear, and bright. Her grasp is quite strong and indicates considerable physical vitality. Indeed, I have never seen a woman 86 years of age with greater physical or mental vigor. As we stood for a few moments exchanging greetings, my companion slipped his hand under her arm. She drew away impatiently, inquiring, "Why do you take hold of my arm?" "To support you," was the reply. "I need no support," said Mrs. Eddy rather independently, "but I think it is better that we all sit down." She indicated a chair beside her table for me and another for my friend, and resumed her seat in a large easy chair, upholstered in red velvet, which she had been occupying before we came into the room. I watched her very closely, every motion that she made, because her physical and mental condition is now the subject of litigation. But during the interview, which lasted about 20 minutes, I did not see the slightest sign of the, quote, senile debility, mental infirmity, or physical incapacity, end quote, which has been alleged as the basis of a suit to deprive her of the care of her property. Probably most readers of this interview were interested in or amused by the rebuff to Mr. Meehan's solicitous action. But Mr. Curtis's account carried a far more important message to the Christian Scientists, if there was one at that time who could read symbols. There is no doubt that the brooch Mrs. Eddy was wearing, fastened at her neck, was her crown of diamonds.